Hello, I'm Edwin Newman. Comment today is devoted to television. It always is, of course, in one sense, being a television program, but I don't mean that. I do mean that our four guests will talk about television, what's wrong with it, what's right with it, and what, in their views, might be done to improve it. Our guests are Jerzy Kosinski, Paul Weaver, Stephanie Harrington, and Martin Mayer. Jerzy Kosinski is a teacher and novelist. He'll speak about the effect of television on children. Paul Weaver is a political scientist and a magazine editor. He will speak about television reporting of politics. He thinks it could be a great deal better. Stephanie Harrington is a writer who has been looking lately at the way women are portrayed on television. She thinks the portrait is dreadful. Martin Mayer is a writer whose latest book is called About Television. He will say about television on this program that it does not try often enough to do anything really good. Jerzy Kosinski comes from Poland. He came to the United States in 1957. Mr. Kosinski is a novelist. His first novel, The Painted Bird, was translated into 36 languages. His second, Steps, won the 1969 National Book Award. In his third novel, Being There, television played a central part. His fourth is due to be published next year. Mr. Kosinski has taught at Wesleyan and Princeton and is now at Yale. His teaching experience has given him some strong opinions about Americans of college age, one of them being that they have short attention spans. He believes that television has a lot to do with that. But now he'll tell us that television does not prepare young people for life at all.
With the advent of television, for the first time in history, all aspects of animal and human life and death, of societal and of individual behavior, have been condensed, on the average, to a 19-inch diagonal screen and a 30-minute time slot. Television, a unique medium claiming to be neither a reality nor art, has become reality for many of us, particularly for our children who are growing up in front of it. Imagine a child watching this little world within which presidents and common folk, mice and lions, kissing lovers and dying soldiers, skyscrapers and doghouses, flowers and detergents, all are reduced to the same size, mixed together, given the same rank, and set in the same screen to be looked at. The child watches this crowded world as he or she pleases, while eating, yawning, playing. What is the outlook of such a child? What does it expect of the world? What can it expect? It expects all things to be as equal as on television. Neither bad nor good, neither pleasant nor painful, neither real nor unreal, merely more or less interesting, merely in better or worse color. It is a world without rank. To such a child, the world is to be looked upon. It is there to entertain its viewer. If it doesn't, one alters it by switching the channels. In the little world of television, all is solved within its magic 30 minutes. In spite of the commercials, the wounded hero either rises or quickly dies, lovers marry or divorce, villains kill or are killed, addicts cured, justice usually wins, war ends. All problems are solved again this week as they were last and will be next week. Life on TV must be visual. This means single-faceted, revealed in a simple speech and through the obvious gesture. No matter how deep the mystery, the TV camera penetrates it. Parents leave their children in front of the TV as babysitter because many feel that it is infinitely safer to watch the sesame world of television than to walk in the world outside of their home. But is it? Unlike television, the child grows older. One day it walks out of the TV room. Against his expectations, he suddenly is put in a classroom full of other children. A child who has been trained to control the little world by changing the channels when he didn't like it, and was accustomed to maintain the same distance between himself and the world televised for his amusement, is naturally threatened by the presence of people he cannot control. Others push him around, make faces at him, and crouch. There is nothing he can do to stop them. He begins to feel that this real world unjustly limits him. It offers no channels to turn to. In this unpredictable world of real life, there are no neatly ordered 30-minute private slot. Here, in life, the child brought up only as a viewer must feel persecuted. Ironically, our industrial state offers few things that can be resolved in 30 minutes. but the teenager keeps expecting it. When it is not, he grows impatient, then adamant, disillusioned, oscillating between the revolutionary scream now and apolitical, cool, so what? He is easily depressed and beaten down. In this world of hierarchy and brutish competition, he is challenged and outranked by others. Soon, he believes he is defective. Instead of coming of age, he is coming apart. This breeding of weak and vulnerable beings knows few exceptions. The kids of the upper classes counteract TV by being involved with real events, real horses, real forests, real mountains, all things they have seen, touched, experienced. They have been given an opportunity to exist outside the television room. However, many middle-class children, and almost all from poor families, are at the mercy of 5 or 6 hours of television a day. My own attitude towards television is neutral. The medium is here to stay. The danger is in the use we make of it. I am involved with TV the way I am with the motor car. The motor car has been with us for over 50 years, but it is only recently that we learned its exhausts pollute our very environment. In today's atomized, disjointed technological society, with so little attention paid to the individual, man needs more than ever the inner strength to carry him through the daily pressures. This strength should come from early exposure to life at its most real, its sudden pleasures, joys and abandonment, but also its violence, its lack of justice, its pain, illness and death. There's subtlety to man's fate, which lies beyond the 13 channels.
The next thing we're going to hear about in connection with television is its coverage of news, particularly political news. The speaker, Paul Weaver, will say that the coverage is biased, but he will also say that it has to be. To him, the question is how it's biased and why. Mr. Weaver is on the government faculty at Harvard and is an editor of Public Interest magazine. He was born in Berkeley, California, but did not go to college there, which is too bad because it would have qualified him for a job he had 2 years ago on the staff of the President's Commission on Campus Unrest. Mr. Weaver is now working on a book about the political influence of news reporting in the United States. It is to be published next year.
Now that another presidential campaign is upon us, I suppose we can look forward to another debate over political bias in television news. Some people will say it's biased, others will insist it isn't. But neither side will get very far because they will be debating the wrong question. The question isn't whether television news is biased. It is. It has to be. It is biased because it's selective. The real question about television news is how it's biased and why. Now, some bias is political in origin. A reporter has a particular opinion, and he lets it affect what he writes. But this kind of bias is quite rare. Most bias in television news comes from a completely different source. It derives directly from the form of the television news story and from the newsman's concept of news. And it exists as a result of his attempt to tell the news dispassionately, professionally. The result often looks like political bias, but it isn't the same thing at all, and we only confuse matters when we fail to notice the difference. As a form, the TV news story is distinguished by the fact that it's built around a single narrative theme, a single idea that ties everything in the story together and maintains the viewer's interest. The theme makes a story easy to follow, but it also means that a story cannot make more than a single point or report more than a single aspect of events. This limitation is compounded by the traditional concept of political news. For more than a century now, American reporters have viewed politics as a game played by politicians solely for the purpose of winning office and power. They do not see politics as a competition of ideas or values, nor do they pay much attention to the personal qualities of politicians. The game is all. And so when they look for the themes around which to write news stories on political events, they focus exclusively on the game aspects. And the result is often a marked pattern of bias. As an example of this, consider the three networks' coverage of the 1968 campaign. The focus throughout was on the campaign as a horse race. The stories dealt not with the issues, but only with who was ahead and who was behind, and who seemed likely to win in the end. During the first half of the campaign, Nixon was way ahead and Humphrey was behind, and their positions weren't changing. Stories about Humphrey focused on how badly his campaign was going and how bleak his prospects were, and the result was a preponderance of material unfavorable to Humphrey. Nixon's stories had just the opposite theme, with the result that there was a rough equality of favorable and unfavorable material about him. But then, toward the end of September, the campaign situation began to change. Humphrey started to come up in the polls, his crowds got bigger, and his chances suddenly started to look better. Nixon was still the front runner, but his lead was getting smaller every day. And the question was whether he could hold on to that lead or whether Humphrey was going to overtake him. As this happened, the themes of news stories about the candidate shifted. Humphrey's stories became overwhelmingly favorable to him as they switched from the theme of the hopeless loser to the theme of the underdog climbing up fast. Nixon's stories became overwhelmingly unfavorable to him as they switched from the theme of the secure front runner to the theme of a man desperately trying to hang on to avoid becoming a three-time loser. By the end of the campaign, the use of these themes had produced an overall pattern of bias against Nixon and more or less balanced treatment of Humphrey. But the cause was evidently not the reporter's political opinions, but only the nature of television journalism itself. So TV news is biased, but usually it's not politically biased. Now, I do not mean to suggest by this that everything is in order in the house of TV journalism. Far from it. There are all kinds of problems with the idea of news itself. For one thing, it creates boredom. It really does get tiresome to be told day after day that one candidate's ahead and the other is behind, or that one candidate's lead is slipping as the other's fortunes rise. More important, TV journalism creates biases for and against candidates on grounds that are irrelevant. Being a winner seems somehow a less important qualification for office than being an able executive or having thoughtful views. But TV rewards candidates for the former and not for the latter. Moreover, the focus on the campaign as a horse race leads newsmen to ignore issues and the candidate's views. And the result is that a citizen has no way to get from news coverage the information required to make a rational choice among candidates. Now, the nightly news is never going to become a forum for philosophers, but it could easily be improved. What's required is an expansion of the newsman's vision of his concept of news. There should be more themes and more variety in political news stories. This will come about the minute newsmen start looking for them. And if that were to happen, I believe television would suddenly discover that most of its critics had turned into friends. The news form would be less impoverished, TV journalism would be much better, and not so incidentally, the nation would be better off as well.
Comment will continue after this message. Never before in the history of televised sports has one network covered every major sports event the way NBC does now. Baseball. Basketball. Football. Hockey. Golf. And tennis. All the top events on one network. Throughout the year, NBC Sports has it all.
Everybody on this program today is a writer. Three are men who are writers, one is a woman who is a writer, Stephanie Harrington. In 1960, Mrs. Harrington started with the Mount Vernon, New York Daily Argus, which is a nice old-fashioned name for a paper, and then she went to the Village Voice in Greenwich Village in New York City. For a while there, she wrote a column on television. Since 1970, Mrs. Harrington has been a freelance. Mrs. Harrington has looked at women as they are represented on television, and she dislikes intensely what she has seen.
Dignity, intelligence, individuality, the ability to make reasoned decisions, these qualities are totally lacking in the American woman, if you could believe what you see on television. In commercials particularly, her image is that of a child woman whose personal worth depends on her ability to please others, friends, family, most of all, husbands. and she pleases them not with her wit or charm, but by keeping her toilet bowls immaculate, her washes super white, and her glassware streak-free. But her position is still not secure unless she manages all of this without allowing her hands to become chapped, her hair messed, her disposition frazzled, or her body to affront her loved ones by emitting the slightest telltale odor. Yet even these accomplishments are not credited to any particular virtue of hers. They are not evidence of her efficiency or energy. They are just more proof that the product she uses can do twice the job in half the time. She is a mere vehicle for demonstrating product performance. Not even her choice of product reflects any credit on her. Judging from the commercials, she buys vacuum cleaners because salesmen dance with them, toilet paper because it's squeezable, and cereal because it will give her an erotic kick in the morning. In the end, nothing human is allowed her. She makes friends in a new town, not because she's likable, but because she serves a certain brand of coffee. Her husband measures her love for him and the children by the fabric softener she uses. Many women have, of course, begun to reject the idea of marriage as the only lifestyle. But even women who find dignity and satisfaction in caring for the family and home, who would freely choose the same work if they had it to do over again, even these women are insulted by this view of the woman as dingbat. In projecting this totally product-determined female caricature, who is no more than a pawn in the male-dominated free enterprise game, television is in fact throwing a 1-2 punch at the self-esteem of American women. First, it reinforces the stereotype of the woman as wife, mother, and homemaker. Then it robs this role of any vestige of dignity. There is little on television that indicates that women actually have a choice between marriage and career. At best, it suggests that if a woman takes the proper iron supplement, she can handle a marriage and a career. It all begins with commercials for children's toys. Despite the protests of women's rights leaders about the early conditioning of children in terms of their sexual roles, toy commercials still show boys playing with cars and girls playing with dolls. Even in situation comedies about career women, the job merely serves as the context for the action, much of which is boy-girl romance. In situation series starring men, however, the main character's medical or legal practice is the very stuff of the drama. Even in adventure series that feature women, like Mission Impossible, the female agent is usually the decoy, who is rescued by the men's courage, split-second timing, and ability to put together devices that self-destruct. The Catwoman on Batman is about the closest thing there is on television to a woman of action. The comics, at least, offer us Wonder Woman and Sheena, Queen of the Jungle. On television, however, adventure is not women's work. Better we should play it safe. Better we should define ourselves in terms of men. Define ourselves as housewives, even though housewives' work as performed on television could be effectively accomplished by a cretin, provided, of course, the cretin is armed with the proper products. Having been thus demeaned to the level of caricature, how are housewives expected to be happy in their work? Easy. They will be loved and cared for by their husbands, particularly if they don't complain. And on the commercials, they never complain, not even if they come down with a virus cold. Besides, if they are dutiful about performing their functions as prescribed on television, they won't have time to worry about being happy. Their days will be utterly consumed in the pursuit of the impossible dream, as embodied in the geritol housewife, who has the cleanest house in town, the best cared for children, serves the finest gourmet meals, is probably writing the great American novel on the side, and still looks like a Vogue cutout when her husband gets home from the office. In return for all of this, she gets the big payoff. Her husband says he'll keep her. The diabolical truth is that keeping up with the geritol lady is impossible. And the pursuit of impossible goals is a quick road to a coronary, a nervous breakdown, or both. But perhaps that's what the advertisers are counting on. If the brains of American women can be kept sufficiently soft, they might not catch on to the fact that they are the major buyers of consumer goods in the United States, and as such, have the power to determine consumer marketing rather than be determined by it.
One of the most versatile writers in this country is Martin Mayer. He's a novelist, he writes a column on music for Esquire, and his articles on education, business, television, law, and other things turn up all over the place. He has been involved in a number of technical studies of education, and for 5 years was chairman of a local school board in New York City. Mr. Mayer himself is a New Yorker and went to Harvard, as I am sometimes tempted to ask on this program, who did not? Mr. Mayer's latest book was called About Television and is generally regarded as an unusually good book on that subject. Mr. Mayer will now tell us that television programs might be better if the old method of sponsorship was still in use, and he will go on from there.
The violinist Misha Elman once complained to Jack Warner that the last Warner Brother movie he had seen had been a stinker. Warner thereupon launched into a disquisition about all the things that had gone wrong in the production of that movie. He was still warming up to his subject when Elman interrupted him. "It's so hard to make bad pictures," Elman said. "Why don't you make good ones?" And it was not entirely a silly thing to say. In art as in science, the answers you find are largely controlled by the questions you ask. Too many people ask wrong or useless questions. In television, for example, people keep talking about sponsors as the cause for bland or mediocre programming. Though television shows have not had sponsors in any meaningful sense for more than 10 years. Indeed, it can be argued that the decision to abandon sponsorship was the tragedy of American television. In radio days and in the early years of television, networks sold time to advertisers. Each advertiser or sponsor supplied his own program. And the price that the network received for the time was paid whether the sponsor's show drew large audiences or small audiences. The sponsor bore all the risks. Except for occasional specials, today's television networks do not sell time periods in which an advertiser can sponsor his own show. They sell minutes on shows presented by the networks themselves. The price the network receives for its minute is a function of the size of the audience drawn by the show in which the minute is embedded. The network, not some sponsor, now bears the risk. Advertisers may have any number of reasons to present something out of the ordinary, and may not feel that they are losers if the audience drawn by their show is relatively small. But the network suffers a measurable monetary loss if a show fails to draw a large audience. The change from sponsorship to what is called participation was made for the best of motives by perhaps the most interesting man ever to hold leadership rank at a network, Pat Weaver, president of NBC in the 1950s. Weaver thought he could draw great audiences for much more ambitious and aesthetically valid stuff than advertisers were likely to risk. And the Federal Communications Commission applauded Weaver's initiative. Under the old system, the FCC argued, control of programming had been lodged with advertisers, whose only interest was peddling their own wares. Under the new system, control of programming would be assumed by those licensed to operate in the public interest. Well, as a look at the schedules for the new season will quickly demonstrate, it didn't work out that way. The sponsorship model may well have been doomed, whatever anyone decided, by the monstrous cost of producing television programs. Under today's participation model, an ordinary half-hour prime-time television series will be expected to generate something more than $7 million of advertising revenue a year, and only a handful of advertisers have that much money in their whole budget. Worse yet, Weaver's belief that shows would draw audiences to the set turned out to be wrong. Typically, television viewing is a habit. The overwhelming majority of viewers, outside as well as inside America, turn on their television set simply to watch television. And the size of the total audience to all programs at 9 o'clock of a Tuesday night in winter is entirely predictable within very narrow limits, regardless of the programs offered. Thus, the competition between networks, or any program suppliers, does not take the form of reaching for special audiences that might like just this program. It takes the form of a zero-sum game, a ceaseless battle for shares of an existing audience, in which one network's gain is always another network's loss. Any competition of this sort, in politics too, necessarily leads to blandness, because it is more important never to push people away than it is to draw them in. More profoundly, people seem to feel less contrast between their most absorbing and least absorbing television experiences. Though there is indeed a good deal of variety in a week, people feel that television is, quote, all the same. To make a program stand out in television, then, may require something shockingly different from the usual, which may mean audiences shockingly smaller than those a television program usually commands. Nevertheless, the effort must be made. Through the National Endowment for the Arts, tens of millions of dollars of tax monies are allocated every year to help pay the bills of theater groups, orchestras, opera companies, ballets all across the country. Such beneficiaries of public support can be asked to make their works available to television at reasonable prices. Meanwhile, stations and networks can be required to set aside a certain amount of time, I have suggested 90 minutes a week for each network, in which our publicly recognized serious artists would receive a chance to approach a larger public. What is wrong with television, after all, is not that most of it is mediocre. That's inevitable. But there is much too little reaching for the best. And surely it is not too much to ask that for 70 of the 7,000 hours which most stations must fill each year, television could try to make Misha Elman's good pictures. And if it fails, as most of the time inevitably it will, should fail grandly rather than dully.
Comment will be back next week. See you then. Edwin Newman, NBC News.
For a printed copy of this program, program number 30, please send 10 cents in coin to Merkle Press, Box 4556, Washington, D.C., 20017. That address again is Merkle Press, Box 4556, Washington, D.C., 20017, program number 30.
Let me tell you about being chief of bureau. Very often that you're the only guy anyway. You can be the super chief of a bureau and you still have to do almost all the work. Moscow, when I was bureau chief, was a place where I did everything from sweep the floor to run a sound camera to write lofty and Toynbee analyses of Soviet policy. You do it all, and that's part of the fun of it. I suppose it was the trial of Francis Gary Powers that at least was the beginning of my Moscow experience. It went, I think, uphill from that. That was a very difficult time to be an American correspondent. I interviewed Khrushchev many times, but we never really got much out of the old man. He was probably more accessible than any other world leader I've ever seen because you could see Khrushchev at parties. And at National Day receptions, he'd beckon the foreign press in, and you could go over and talk to him. So I've talked to him a lot.
Experience. It shows on NBC Nightly News.